understand God is still very much a force in the world. The religious insight has a huge amount of good to do in terms of inspiration, comfort. I don't think it's running out of steam at all.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. And every week here on Premier Christian Radio, we bring you The Profile, where we sit down with a different Christian and hear something of their life story and their faith journey. And I'm really delighted to say that my guest this week on the show is Michael Wakelin. He is the executive chair of the Religion Media Centre and the former head of religious broadcasting at the BBC. In his spare time, he's a faith advisor to the Football Association, the FA, and he's a lifelong supporter of Norwich City. Potentially controversially, maybe we'll come on to that. Michael is also a former Premier trustee, so I had better be on my best behaviour today, hadn't I? Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Sam. Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you in. We like to start at the beginning here on the show, so if you wouldn't mind, take me back to early life, growing up. What are your memories of childhood? And perhaps, where did the Christian faith first come into the picture for you?
Well, I actually started life in Sierra Leone, but was born in London. My parents were missionaries. My father was a missionary doctor working with the Methodist Church. And we were really out in the bush in a very dangerous place for young children. And my mum, having given birth to me, I've got an older brother and sister, so they're twins. And they were like, you know, 3 years older than me. And then she had these two toddlers and a tiny baby from 9 months old living in a really dangerous place where there were ants and snakes and there was a cobra story when I was apparently sat in my nappies in the living room and a cobra came into the living room and mum yelled for one of the gardeners. She said, snake, snake, and this chap came in and he shot it. That must be in my memory bank somewhere. And we were invaded by ants overnight. They were swarming all over the walls and we had 22 chickens and in the morning they were feathers and bones. It was a very dangerous place. Plus it was rife with disease. And mum got ill and eventually dad, who was working in this hospital, we decided we had to come back from Sierra Leone and we were sent out to Kenya, which was much easier in terms of sort of health and safety. And we lived there for a couple of years and then we settled in Norfolk. So that's where I began life. But my parents are both devout Christians. My mum, after father died back in 1979, she actually went on to become a Methodist minister. So faith was all around me growing up. And I, unlike other people, I suppose, I never had any reason or desire to reject it. It always seemed to make sense to me. My mum had a huge influence on my theological thinking. I went to a Christian boarding school, Kingswood School, which was founded by John Wesley for the children of Methodist ministers. And I was in one of the last years where there was actually quite a number still of Methodist minister sons, which was it was set up to educate them. And they're still my best friends now, and two of them have gone on to become Methodist ministers. I didn't go down that road, which for other reasons we can talk about, but certainly Methodism, kind of Christianity, has always been in my blood, in my bones, and for me, it's the only thing that really sort of makes sense of it all, and the deeper I go into it, kind of the more sense it makes. So yeah, a huge part of my life, right from when I was a child and growing up in rural Methodism.
Yeah, and Sierra Leone and Kenya. I mean, experiencing those places as a child, does that give you a greater appreciation of the bigness and the difference of the world we live in, the difference between nations and communities and cultures? You imbibed all that as a child. Do you think that made a difference to your outlook on life?
Well, it's bound to have influenced me in my very formative years. I was too little, really, to remember much of it. My mum tells a story of when we were leaving Africa. My dad stayed on there for a bit in Nairobi, and we were getting on the plane, and the engines all around us were very loud, and I was screaming and screaming, and mum had two other little children with her, my brother and sister, and luggage and stuff. And she was asking for help, and two people came up to offer their help. There was a white businessman in a suit, and there was a black businessman in a suit. And I held my arms out to the black businessman. So that was obviously a sign of what I was used to seeing around me anyway. But I don't know. It's hard to calculate or find out how much effect that would have had on me. But clearly, I've always enjoyed my overseas travel. I myself worked in South Korea for 2 years. I had that itch to get abroad, and I worked for the Methodist Church out in South Korea too.
Yeah, and you mentioned this whole kind of family embrace of Methodism and that being your background, but you didn't go down the Methodist minister route yourself. So tell me more about, if you know, if I'd met you sort of aged 18 and said, what do you want to do with your life? What would you have said at that point?
Well, curiously, Sam, at the age of 18, I was still thinking I probably would be a Methodist minister. I think when I studied theology at Birmingham University, it was quite a radical place to study theology. There was a massive Christian Union on campus, and I had friends in the Christian Union. The department itself had one or two very controversial theologians, including a chap called John Hick, who was considered to be very left and not proper Christian, even though he was a URC minister. And I think he had a big effect on me. And I think I started to quite like the debate and the discussions around it, and I didn't want to be kind of pigeonholed and, you know, forced to follow a particular way of thinking. And I think my mind broadened then a little bit more, wanting to stay very much involved in the church, but not actually wanting to be, you know, I've signed on the dotted line, this is what I'm going to be preaching about. Not at that stage. So I think my liberal tendency put me off becoming a minister.
Mm. And was studying theology originally a bit of a plan to go into being a minister? That was the reason you picked up in the first place.
Well, I've talked about my mum and the theological influence she had on me, but my brother also had a huge theological influence on me. He was very brilliant speaking. He's still one of the best preachers around, I think. You know, he's retired now. We shared a bedroom for quite a while, and he used to talk about theology into the night. And I obviously put him on a pedestal as my elder brother. And he went to Nottingham and read theology, did very well. And I thought, yeah, I want to read theology. So it wasn't an issue for me. And so I went to Birmingham, and that was the most exciting place to go to do it. And yeah, I suppose, as I say, gradually during that time, I moved away from actually wanting to go into the ministry, whereas my brother went straight into it.
Right, so not into the ministry, but into the media in quite a strong way, which we'll come on and talk about. Just tell me how that developed.
Well, when I was at school, my mum had actually started doing Prayer for the Day on Radio 4, and I had been down to the BBC a couple of times, and it was back in the day when it was very much kind of part of the empire. And we were taken out to this lovely BBC club where there were waiters, silver service waiters, and tea and scones and things, all very dignified. You would never get that these days.
I was about to say, but I don't back think then that's it was quite what happens
it
now.
It was proper old BBC, and I got a bit of the, you know, wow, this is exciting then. But I had a friend at school, Simon Topping, whose father was Frank Topping, who's quite well known in Christian circles as a broadcaster. And I used to get my letters from my parents, which were laid out at the boarding school on this window ledge, and my name, W, Simon Topping, T, our letters were often next to each other, and his letters came from a BBC, in a BBC envelope.
Wow.
And it was that. I just looked at that and thought, wow, that's exciting. You can actually work for something like the BBC, which was a glorious thing back then, and get paid for it. And I thought, that's my route. So I think that's when the media kind of thing was embedded in my imagination, and I went very much single-mindedly towards that with a slight diversion in career, and that was where I ended up when I came back from Korea. It was at Radio Norfolk.
Okay, Radio Norfolk was the beginning, and what was the role there?
Well, I used to do the church news really badly, but and I wasn't, I've never really a very good journalist, I'm still not, but I was put on the news desk, and one of my early jobs was to ring round the police stations to make sure if there'd be any stories for the lunchtime news bulletin. And anyway, I was told to ring up, and I rang up this place in Dereham in Norfolk, and I rang up the constable there, and I said, I'm ringing from Radio Norfolk, are there any stories for us? And he said, oh, yeah, these thieves tried to break into a pub. And I said, oh, yeah, did they get anything? He said, oh, no, they were frightened away by the geese. And I thought, oh, so nothing was stolen. And he said, no, nothing was stolen. So I didn't bother telling the news editor. Then the Eastern Evening News came out, front page, Hero Geese Save Pub. And I'd completely missed the story. So ever since then, I've doubted my talent as a journalist. I've learned a lesson from that, but yeah.
Well, many others have not doubted your talents, because you've gone on to have an amazing career in the media. I mentioned at the beginning, I mean, head of religion at the BBC, that's an absolutely huge job. So just fill in some of the blanks for us between missing the geese story and head of religion.
Yeah, well, I wrote into the head of religious broadcasting and said, look, I've got a theology degree. I've lived in South Korea for 2 years. I did a bit of broadcasting out there as well, actually. And I said, you know, any jobs? And he wrote back saying, well, we're looking for a researcher for a series on the Bible with Brian Redhead, who was a very famous broadcaster back then. I'm sure the listeners are all far too young to remember him, but he was an idol of mine on the Today programme on Radio 4. Anyway, I went in and got the job as a researcher, and they liked me and they kept me on. And then I got a job doing a bit of reporting for the Sunday programme on Radio 4. And then I was sort of sucked into the Radio 2 side of things, which actually fitted my lack of intellectual brilliance, I think, better. And I loved the stories and the music and the gospel music. And I got into that, and they made me a producer, producing Good Morning Sunday on Radio 2 and Pause for Thought on Radio 2, which I still do to this day. And I loved the energy behind that kind of more popular end of broadcasting. And I made a special thing of doing Radio 1 documentaries, I suppose they were. We did a big project on Martin Luther King, relevant to Jesse Jackson just dying, actually, where we set a lot of his speeches to music. And that ended up getting a Sony Award for creative use of radio, which was a big career launch for me, because once you had one of those, it was like the Oscar at the time. And that opened doors, and I was, you know, obviously taken a bit more seriously. And then I made the Radio 2 franchise my own, and with extra Radio 1 stuff. And then I brought in gospel music with lots of help from others, but John Forrest particularly. But I then got to meet all these fabulous gospel musicians, and we went over to America, and we did lots of interviews with some of the real greats, like Edwin Happy Day Hawkins and Richard Smallwood, the Clark Sisters, all the great gospel choirs out there at the time. And I brought them to Radio 2, Radio 1 as well, a bit on Radio 1. But most of all, I met Gloria Gaynor. Wow. I was a huge fan of hers. Yeah. I used to listen to her on my radio at boarding school singing I Will Survive, that came later, but How High the Moon and Never Can Say Goodbye. And then I got to the BBC and I said, oh, why did we ask Gloria Gaynor to do something? And back then it was so easy. I kind of rang up her agent and said, oh, yeah, this is her number. Within about 3 weeks, I was sat in her living room talking to the great Gloria Gaynor. And then she came over and did a gospel series for me, several gospel series, The Gospel Train. And that led on to meeting people like Denise Williams and Beverly Knight eventually. And I kind of gave gospel a bit of a leg up. But in the end, it all got terribly expensive, and they kind of cancelled the series in the end. But I met the, you know, wonderful Karen Gibson and, sorry, my mind's gone blank. Anyway, I met lots of wonderful gospel musicians who I'm still in touch with today, and I was very proud of that.
Yeah, it's amazing. Sometimes as Christians, when we talk about calling, people interpret that as, well, a calling is a calling into the priesthood or into the ministry or being a vicar. But there's another sense in which a lot of Christians would say, well, no, I'm called to my profession as a bricklayer. Did you feel during this time a sense of God has called me to media and I'm getting all of these opportunities and there's a sense in which this is what God wants me to do and that's just as important or as notable as being a Methodist minister?
Yes, in a way, I did feel that calling. I think with a lot of things, maybe listeners will identify with this, you kind of notice God's hand in things when you look back more than at the time. Because at the time, I was literally rolling with the joy of it all and indeed rolling with the punches a bit too at times. But it all seemed perfect for me because it was playing into all the things I enjoyed and loved and was passionate about. You know, my faith, the music, gospel, it was all very easy. Now, looking back on that now, I can see that it was extraordinary that I was in that position and given those opportunities. And I'm very, very grateful to them now in a way that I didn't notice so much at the time. Yes, I say it was a calling, and I was just dead lucky to get such a very interesting one that played into my strengths.
So tell me about the big job, the head of religion at the BBC. How did that come about?
Well, I had a very, you know, some good breaks. I left radio and went to Songs of Praise for a bit. That was in the days when Songs of Praise really was a mighty Sunday evening show with 7 or 8, 9 million viewers. And I was trained by some real experts, the wonderful Roger Hutchings and people like that. I was mentored by some great people. And I did a bit of directing, did a bit of producing. And then we were moved up to Manchester by John Burt. And at the time, that felt like a real kick in the teeth for us. But actually, looking back on it, it was quite good for religious broadcasting in some ways. And it was good for me. And I managed to take a few steps up and ended up being series producer of Songs of Praise, while also doing my radio as well up to that point. And that gave me kind of a lot of experience, which was looked on favourably. I then did a bit of documentary work. We did a documentary for BBC One called Son of God, which was presented by Jeremy Bowen, the Middle Eastern correspondent at the time, now world editor, I think he is. And that involved filming with all the latest gizmos. We recreated the first century temple. We had actors, all the disciples and Jesus, and lots of really exciting stuff. And I was very lucky to be in that.
Very vivid production.
I was part of that. And then we got a Radio Times front cover, which was extremely good. You know, that's a sign that you've sort of made it. I mean, it was nothing to do with me, really. I was working with fabulously talented people who really knew what they were doing, but I was kind of on their coattails. But that also stood me in good stead. And then when they didn't really know what they were doing with the head of religion job, because they had appointed somebody who wasn't religious, but he was excellent manager, Alan Bookbinder. And then there was a kind of an interim person. And again, they were sort of thinking, what are we going to do? So they advertised it again, but none of my immediate colleagues above me wanted to apply, because I think they thought it was a bit of a poison chalice. So I rather foolishly put my hand up and went through the process and then got the job, which was like, oh my goodness, what do I do now? And for 2 or 3 years, it worked really well. Things fitted in quite nicely, but the political tide was tough. I made some mistakes. I wasn't good at everything at all. And looking back on it now, it was a tough time. And then I think they did a big kind of reorganize, and I was reorganized not to be there. But I suppose if you wanted to have look at God's hand in all this, at the time it felt devastating. But looking back on it, it was the best thing that ever happened.
Wow.
Absolutely best thing. It took a little while for it to look like that, must be said. But for me, it was a fantastic opportunity.
Can you just explain sort of both halves of that? So tell us what was going on. I guess what went wrong that made it so devastating? And then also why, looking back now, you see it as a positive?
Well, it felt kind of... A lot of things had happened which had kind of undermined our department, which were not really to do with me at all. You know, some of our work was taken away and given to other parts of the BBC. There were things happening more in the bigger picture at the BBC. I think the fact we were up in Manchester started to be quite a big negative back then. And I think they wanted to move on to a different sort of model with a different sort of emphasis. And as happens when you get up to these senior positions, you know, sometimes your face doesn't quite fit. But I'd done well in lots of things, but some things hadn't gone so well. So when it kind of came about, they restructured and I had to apply for my job. So it wasn't actually this is your red card, Michael, but it was a bit, you now got to apply for your job. And I did, and I didn't get it. So that's how it actually happened. But then looking back on it, I was such a corporate man, I suppose, that the idea of leaving the BBC was like losing your umbilical cord. I mean, it was like, what do I do now? And I had a very definite moment when it felt like no one would ever employ me again. I had 3 kids at private school. I had a mortgage, had a lovely wife, and I had to think, what on earth do I do now? How am I going to get any money? I got a payout, which was great, generous. But then I looked at it and thought, I've got to actually earn some money. And then I remember someone saying to me on Macclesfield Station, he looked at me and said, Michael, feel the freedom. Feel the freedom. And I thought, I don't want to feel the freedom. I want to crawl back into Auntie and go and get paid every month. Thank you very much. But then, you know, one step here didn't work out. And then I looked into chaplaincy, didn't work out. And then another door opened. And then I sort of went down and chatted to this chap running this charity called Coexist. That opened a door, another door opened. And I remember after this was about, I'd only lost 1 year of my gardening leave. One month of my gardening leave. And I'd been to see this chap and I'd suggested some ideas. And I got this phone call just before Christmas, whenever it was, 2010. And they said, Michael, we'd like you to start in January. And I shouted so loud, my children all burst into tears. They thought something awful had happened. But I was suddenly realised, oh, gosh. And then that opened. Then someone else rang up and said, can you come back and do Pause for Thought? That's how I started, on Pause for Thought. And then another door opened. And after about 6 months, I was turning stuff down.
Wow. There you go. Well, it's a lovely story of God's providence. And
looking back on it, it certainly looks like that now.
Yeah.
Didn't at the time.
And you've gone on to do some equally amazing things, which I'm eager to come to. Before we do, just sticking with the BBC for a moment, not just during your time as head of religion, but throughout your BBC career, was there ever this tension, potentially for you, but even for your Christian friends, in how they perceived what you were doing? Because on the one hand, you as a Christian are at the BBC and able to bring your faith to work and make religious programs and, you know, bring God into your day-to-day life, which is wonderful. On the other hand, you're not employed to be an ambassador for Christianity, and certainly not an ambassador for a particular kind of Christian faith. The whole point of the BBC is it's quite broad, including during your role as head of religion. Was there ever a bit of a tension or a misunderstanding there with perhaps Christians who felt that, you know, you could walk into work and just turn all the airwaves over to Jesus Christ and talk constantly about your faith, when actually that was never really possible in that kind of a role? And was there ever a struggle for you in seeking to balance, yes, I can bring my faith to work, but I'm not here to just, you know, dominate my own Christian views on what is ultimately a mainstream station?
That's very well put. I think you had to be very careful about that. And I think when I was kind of young and eager, and I was a bit more evangelical, I suppose, I wanted to bring about, you know, quite a strong Christian feeling into, especially things like Pause for Thought. However, around that time, it was when interfaith was opening up. And I remember putting on Muslims onto Pause for Thought, and Hindus, and that kind of window was opening for me, which has become incredibly important later on in my journey. So it was just beginning to change. And the thing that I discovered when I left the BBC was a narrative around religious literacy. And I wish I'd had that when I was at the BBC. I'd have been a much better head of religious broadcasting if I'd had that in my toolkit. Because religious literacy talks about the importance of religion without being religious. It says religion really matters to people. And it matters to them right in here, in their heart, in their soul. In order to understand that, you don't have to be religious yourself, but you have to go out of your way to understand that their terminology, what makes them tick. And that's the work I do now, is all around religious literacy. And I think that's what the BBC is really about. And I used to have huge admiration for the BBC. And I think now what I'd be wanting to do is to make sure the whole of the BBC was religiously literate. Mm. It's reporters, and, you know, it's drama department, it's documentary department. That's what matters more than having a religious department that is, you know, powerfully putting over a particular faith.
Sure. And it'd be great to talk some more about that concept of religious literacy. Just before we get there, you mentioned that you were perhaps, I think the word you used was a bit more evangelical as a youngster. So just using that as example of putting a Muslim onto Pause for Thought, just talk me through what would have been in your mind as a young person and why that might have been a struggle, or you might have even felt like, am I compromising here by putting someone on the airwaves whose views I completely disagree with, and kind of how you've resolved that or dealt with that tension later on in your career, and why that's something I guess you're not embarrassed about today.
Well, it wouldn't have totally disagreed with everything I believe. I think I've, when I use the word evangelical, then I don't think I was meaning in a kind of fundamentalist biblical sense. I was meaning more in an enthusiasm for religious sense. And I quickly realised that, yeah, other faiths' views, particularly in the broadcasting context, are equally valid. So that was never really a tension for me, because I've found people of other faiths interesting back then. I find them very valuable now, while still maintaining my Christian faith. So,
but to use another example, you know, like a church leader wouldn't give, most church leaders wouldn't give the pulpit over to a Muslim on a Sunday. They'd say, I as a Christian am called to present biblical truth. And they might say to you, you as a Christian at the BBC, you know, you're not called to put other people on the microphone who disagree with everything we stand for. Why are you doing that? You know, how would you answer that kind of a objection?
I don't think I ever felt that was a call for me. I always knew that, you know, the BBC had to represent everybody. And, you know, it had to represent all the license fee payers. And for me, it was actually a welcome addition to the rich mosaic of expression that was available to us. So it was never really a conflict.
Mm. Tell me more about BBC Pause for Thought. You mentioned it was your first job at the BBC, and you continue to executive produce the segment. This is probably a completely unfair question to ask, but are there just maybe one or two stories from that time or one or two contributions that particularly stick in your mind?
That's a completely unfair question, Sam, and you know it is.
There must be one or two that stand out as particularly special. Maybe related to what was going on in the news and how the next day someone picked that up so well, or just maybe personally, someone who says something you think, actually, that's speaking to me, let alone the millions listening.
Well, we've had some fantastic contributors over the years. There was one recently from Cole Morton, who's one of our regular contributors. This is on the Scott Mills Breakfast Show, the biggest breakfast show in Europe, a nuts audience. And to have a religious slot in the heart of that is such a privilege. He talked about his dad and taking him out when he had dementia to a pub and getting him his favourite old thing, which was whitebait. And he just talked about his dad eating this whitebait and the expression on his face because he was struggling, you know, with dementia. It seemed like, when we saw the response, that the nation had come to a standstill.
Wow.
And the emails that were coming in, you know, people in floods of tears saying, you know, I can't believe I've just heard this. And it was so simple.
Yeah.
Such a simple thing. And one thing that I've always insisted on with Pause for Thought, right from the very beginning, is that it's religious. And I remember when we took it on back in 2010, when I was invited back into the Pause for Thought fold at the BBC, you know, there was something in the air that said, oh, we try to, you know, tell people not to be too religious on Pause for Thought. Well, stuff that for a game of soldiers. You know, we're going to be religious on Pause for Thought because it's so important. So I kind of hopefully reintroduced the theology back into it, I think. It's unfair on my predecessors, but it seemed it needed a bit of a kick in that direction. So we are always very religious, and there's always, you never should end a Pause for Thought not knowing what faith has been presented to you that morning. Yeah. But back to people. I remember Adrian Plass. People will remember him with fondness. He was very, very good at Pause for Thought, and he would make us laugh. I always tried, if possible, to keep it light and energetic and funny and stories. No preaching. We never let them preach. Self-deprecation works really well on Pause for Thought. And we've just got some fabulous contributors. So it's more the contributors I remember than specific ones. But we definitely sometimes you hit the nerve.
Yes.
And you feel people are pulling into lay-bys and, you know, dealing with their tears.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99. A moment ago, you were explaining how, you know, the BBC's job is to broadcast for the whole country, and that's why it's perfectly reasonable for you as a Christian to put people of other faiths on the airways. But couldn't that argument also be used slightly against your position in the sense that if you listen to people like the National Secular Society, they will say, well, atheism is growing, more and more people are ticking no religion on the census. Therefore, why interrupt the biggest breakfast radio show in the country with a unashamedly religious segment that doesn't represent the views of the country? And whether it's that or the other one, which is Radio 4's Thought for Today, Thought for the Day, often gets criticised by secularists who say, actually, we don't want religion on the airwaves, and it's no longer representative of the country in which we live. What's your response to people saying that?
Well, whatever they say, religion is a massively important force in the world. And the stats are debatable, but, you know, certainly 80% of the world are very religious. And that's a situation that's likely to grow, not go down. So in order to understand the world and the way it ticks, you need to understand religion. So I would argue the case for Thought for the Day and Pause for Thought on the basis of religious literacy, at the very least, that we need to understand the religious mind in order to understand the way the world works and the way it's going. So I think there's a real need for that. I mean, maybe that's more important on Thought for the Day. But, you know, to suddenly pretend that religion's going out of fashion, I mean, you know, it's nonsense, I think. There was a famous story of The Economist magazine having a front page in 2001, and the big headline was God is Dead. In 2010, they had another one saying God is Back. And did God actually go anywhere?
No, he didn't.
So he's, you know, she, whoever you understand God, is still very much a force in the world. And I think it's still, as is evident from the response we get to Pause for Thought, the religious insight has a huge amount of good to do in terms of inspiration, comfort, and I don't think it's running out of steam at all.
Absolutely. Well, if it's not running out of steam, that does bring us rather neatly onto the question of why some of the Christians I speak to actually have quite a low opinion sometimes of the BBC in general. And as you know, the BBC receives plenty of criticism, I'm sure much of it completely unfair and maybe some of it fair as well. But, you know, Christians will say to me things like Songs of Praise, you mentioned, you were involved in, had millions of viewers at one time. But, you know, that programme, much loved by many Christians, being relegated away from the tea time slot to the lunchtime slot, or maybe they'll talk about BBC News output in, to your point, not really understanding religious literacy and maybe doing an awful lot in the Church of England and not representing the other denominations so much. You know, you would have heard these criticisms before, but as someone who's worked at the BBC for such a long time and is a Christian, what's your response when you meet Christians who they just don't feel like the BBC is either fair to the Christian faith, and also just perhaps not representing it nearly as well as it could do?
Well, I can't speak on behalf of the BBC because I'm no longer employed by them, except doing Pause for Thought. Well, I think it would be very hard to put Songs of Praise back in prime time. I don't think anyone would really argue with that because things have shifted so much. That's not to say that it should be there. You know, it's still covering an important franchise. But I don't think anyone would shift that back to where it was. You've got to be realistic and understand what's making the world tick at the moment. What we do now, I do a lot of media training, is we kind of pass the ball back to the religious communities, whatever faith they are, and say, look, what you've got to do is learn how to broadcast, because everyone's a broadcaster now. You can't just expect, you know, the BBC, whoever it is, to come to you with a microphone and a set of cameras and represent your faith. You've got all your platforms. Don't need to list them all. Learn how to do your video to your phone. And there's some brilliant people out there talking to their phones and producing fantastic stuff. I follow several people.
You have far more followers than some BBC channels.
Oh, yeah, of course they do. So I don't think that the idea of sort of blaming the broadcasters now is... it's just irrelevant. It's just an old-fashioned thing to do. Get yourselves out there and do the stuff. And actually, you'll probably do it better anyway. And then you're in control of it. There's a thing called the Fifth Estate, which is the rise of the parish magazine. Because lots of the big journalist organisations like Reach PLC, NewsQuest, the BBC, indeed, have pulled back from local reporting for financial reasons. Like the 39 Sunday morning breakfast shows on BBC local radio were cut back, was it a year ago, back to 13. So, you know, the Radio Norfolk Sunday morning show comes from Dunstable. So a massive cutback. But this is an opportunity, as all challenges are, as we know. And now local people can take control of their media. They can organise their own productions. And we go around the country with the Religion Media Centre doing Creating Connections, which brings together local media, local influencers and religious groups and gets them to talk to each other. And that's opening up all sorts of doors and new partnerships and possibilities. So as everything, you know, all is harvest, as my sister tells me. This is a good thing. You know, let's make this work for us.
Yes. Well, absolutely. I think the challenge there to Christians, to churches, to Christian organisations, to get involved and rather than sitting back and moaning about the media, to engage with the existing media and, as you say, to make the most of the opportunities these brand new channels, digital platforms afford us is a good thing to be doing. I'm pleased you mentioned the Religion Media Centre. You are the executive chair of that, and it exists to help the media report and reflect religion in society. And we've spoken a bit actually already about why that's so needed, this assumption that you can't really understand the world we live in today without understanding the religious lens to it. So tell me a bit more about what you're seeking to do and how it's going to a certain extent. You know, how much you feel like that message is really cutting through. You're talking to a lot of journalists, trying to help them to understand why religion matters in all sorts of different stories. I guess not just the quote-unquote religious stories, but perhaps in the world affairs stories or the healthcare stories. There's often a religious element, isn't there?
Yeah, there often is. And there was a conference held in like 2009, I think, when lots of church religious leaders got together with lots of media bigwigs, and they all decided that religion wasn't being very well reported. The outcome of this was, why didn't we have a religion media centre? And then it went into the wilderness for a bit. A feasibility study was done, and then, again, this is one of these moments when I put my hand up rather foolishly. There was no one else left to chair the sort of fledgling group of people. We had no money. And there were like six of us who all thought, yeah, we should do something about this. This is 2015. We went off and got a little bit of funding, got a website going. Then we got a bit more funding and got a bit more of a website going. And then we got a chunk of money from Porticus, who are fabulous. And we then really set it up. And we went from naught followers in 2016. Our social media reach is now 1.3 million. Wow. All around the world. Our daily bulletins are, you know, opened by thousands. Our YouTube channels watched by thousands. We interviewed Richard Moth, the new Archbishop of Westminster, a couple of days ago. And we put it out, and within a day, it had got over 20,000 views. We know that there is a need for what we're offering. We offer independent coverage of religion. We're not doing anything other than saying religion is really important and we should understand it. We don't say it's good. We don't say it's bad. We just cover it. And that's got us a degree of respect and a following, which is, I just wake up in the morning and think, I just can't believe how well this has gone. Nothing to do with me. I mean, literally, the work is all done by others. Ruth, she knows who she is. And Ollie, he knows who he is. And it's just a wondrous thing. Mm. I can't believe it.
Am I right in thinking that in 2015, 2016, when you set up, there was this assumption, which I think a lot of people would agree with, that a lot of journalists are themselves quite secular, atheist, or whatever they believe, just don't really have much of a personal connection to anything religious, and therefore they're starting on the back foot of finding it hard to comprehend religious stories. Is that a fair assumption as to why you were started?
We used to think that a bit. I think the thing with journalists, they're bright. They're busy.
We are. We're very bright, Michael.
They're bright and they're busy. And when it comes to a complex story, you know, what they need is, you know, a shortcut to a better understanding. And that's why they come to us. Our fact sheets are hugely popular, and they ring us up and we give them steers and advice. Sometimes, you know, there's a bit more perhaps hostility in the media than in other branches of society, perhaps. But my love for journalists is such that we want to help them do the job they need to do. They want to tell stories, and they need, you know, sometimes help to get those stories understood. So that's what we try to do. But we don't just help journalists. I mean, we're followed by academics and students, teachers. You know, lots of people come to the Religion Media Centre because they know they can trust our content.
And have you got any stories to help us to understand the impact of Religion Media Centre and, you know, why it's so good that, I mean, relatively new organisation, not been around that long, but why it's so good and so needed that you exist and the difference that you've been able to make?
Well, we've been, other people, you know, independent people not connected to Religion Media Centre have now pointed out to us the difference we have made in the way religion is reported. Mm-hmm. I think some of the top journalists would acknowledge that too. They don't always acknowledge the stuff they take from us. They know they should. But we've certainly made a difference in the way religion is reported. I'm thinking of one particular story. I think I probably shouldn't mention the supermarket concerned, but this is something I got involved with through the Religion Media Centre quite early on. There was an advert in the Evening Standard from this said supermarket, household name, and it said, this is on Maundy Thursday, I was reading this, and it said, Good Friday just got better.
Oh, no.
Cuts on beer and cider and wines.
Oh, no.
And I sent off an email, and very quickly, I was on Five Live, fairly quickly, they picked up on the story. Tesco's, within 6 hours, had removed the story and apologised. So I think that was a sign of real religious illiteracy in the media. And they were, you know, shamefaced. They clearly had not understood the meaning of the word good in relation to Friday. For them, it was an opportunity to go and get, you know, inebriated. So that's the kind of thing we need to keep, you know, pick up on and, you know, and encourage out of the door.
I can think of Christians, I remember that story, and I can think of Christians who would have responded to that story in all sorts of different ways. But, you know, some Christians would have been borderline pretty angry about that. And might have even said something like, well, hang on, that supermarket would have never dared messed around with the language of a Muslim or a Hindu important festival. They just wouldn't have done it. I mean, do you agree with that kind of assumption? And if you do, does that say something about the moment we're in as Christians, where sometimes Christians feel like we are just a bit unfairly treated compared to others? What's your take on that?
Well, I think, yeah, all religions should be treated fairly. I think Christians have got used to being a bit of the butt of jokes, and especially in sort of sitcoms and things, that we are supposed to get a bit used to it because we've been so much in the majority for such a long time. On Five Live the other day, there was one of the presenters said, well, of course, today is Pancake Tuesday. So I texted in saying, come on, we can do better than this. It is actually Shrove Tuesday. We eat up all the fat, we eat up our eggs and, you know, all that to make our pancakes. That's why it's important. And to be fair, they did change it straight away.
Okay.
So,
well, there might be a lesson there in how we engage as well, because if I'm sure your email was very polite.
Of course it was.
Very measured.
Sam.
And I wonder if some other emails that Christians, myself included, might have been guilty of sending in the past have been less productive. It's about how we express ourselves, treating journalists with respect, isn't it?
Well, love, respect. They're busy. They need our help and care.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm keen to talk about a certain love of yours, which is, of course, football. When I met you today, you were even wearing a Norwich scarf. Weren't you? And telling me all sorts of stories. Now, I understand you're an advisor to the FA on faith, which is a pretty amazing position. But tell me, why does the Football Association need an advisor on faith, and what does that role
involve? It's the only cool thing I've ever done. I think it's actually not an official role. However, he does. The head of diversity at the Football Association has gathered together round him two representatives of all the major faiths, because he, which I think is a brilliant idea, he's reaching out into all the communities to kind of spread the word about football, but to get them all involved in football too, to help break down barriers, to, you know, eradicate prejudice. And football is such a uniting agent. It's astonishing. I mean, there are people who aren't interested in football at all, of course, and I have respect for them. Some of my friends really don't get it either. But it is such a powerful force for good. And if we can use that to improve religious understanding, how exciting is that? Mm. And I was talking to someone who works at Christians in Sport, and they said when they were a footballer, and they started, there were four Christians that he knew about in the entire of the football leagues. And now, you know, there's tons. And there's Muslims and other faiths represented in football, and I'm just really excited by that. So I've come in, I'm actually on, unusually for me, I'm on the Christian ticket with that. But normally, as I say, I'm more into faith and more across all faiths. But this particular role is to help advise about the Christian thing. But that's a welcome joy.
Yeah. Well, we've been reporting on this group, Ballers in God,
which
is phenomenal. I mean, it's an absolutely huge Instagram account. We interviewed John Bostock, who runs that. And it's effectively a bit of a Christian union, really, for you know, professional elite football players who also have a faith. And if you follow that channel, you'll see, you know, very well-known footballers being baptised and sharing their faith and all sorts of things going on. I do wonder if there's been a bit of a shift, just thinking specifically about Christianity and football. I mean, you already mentioned that in the time you've been a football fan, that the dynamic seems to have shifted in terms of just far more players expressing a Christian faith, certainly being open about their Christian faith. Is this part of what some people have called a quiet revival, that actually, you know, after a long period of secularisation and atheism seeming to be on the ascendancy, and after those years of the God delusion and Richard Dawkins, we're just in a different moment now in terms of the culture and the way faith generally is perceived, that there is both an increased interest in religion, but also specifically for Christianity, this quiet revival, this increased interest amongst Gen Z in particular, and increased willingness to be just upfront and open and public about your faith.
Well, you've mentioned quiet revival twice there. I was going to skip over it once, but mentioning it twice, if you've been following the Religion Media Centre news, there is a certain a degree of questioning around the Quiet Revival and how actual that is because of this business of opt-in surveys. So a bit of doubt has been cast on that. However, I'm fairly sure there is quite a lot more interest around spirituality and Christianity, whether it's growing as much as they would like to think, I doubt. But certainly the football situation with Christians, it's the foreign footballers coming in from South America and Africa. These are the ones who are bringing their Christian faith to the football pitch, and how lovely it is to see. And indeed the Muslim friends as well, expressing their faith on the pitch. And that incident when they broke the fast, was it last year, during a game, which I thought was monumentally interesting. It's kind of that business of giving faith its proper place that I'm excited about. And I think that's what, you know, certainly in the football terms, that's really happening now. It's not being pushed aside. And even at Norwich City, they've got a chaplain, and there was some great stuff on their social media showing the Christian players gathering together to pray before a game. And, you know, how nice is that?
Yeah.
Although God's a rubbish football supporter, because all he wants is for everyone to pray, play fairly and be good kind of thing. He would never actually support your team, which I think is disappointing. I'm sure he's really green and yellow.
Yes, well, that age-old debate of exactly who God supports. yeah, well, let's not go there. But what are your hopes for that kind of role that you're doing with the FA? What would be a good outcome from having that kind of role in seeking to talk about Christianity and football together? What's the big idea?
I suppose for me it would be, you know, that normalisation of faith in any workplace. Actually, that's another big thing we probably haven't got time to talk about. But yeah, the accommodation of religion in the workplace broadly, and that why doesn't that should also include the football pitch and the football dressing room and the big football clubs around. I mean, they were all started by churches anyway, weren't they?
I was about to mention
as they were in Germany.
I was about to mention there is quite an interesting kind of Christian history to a lot of the
a lot
clubs.
Of the clubs.
You'll know this far better than me, but maybe you can tell a couple of stories
Everton, Aston Villa were based on church boys' clubs, and indeed Manchester City was as well. And I discovered recently that the same is true in Germany. They came out of churches wanting to give young boys something healthy to do. So, yeah, there's a deep Christian route to it all. And a very interesting one at West Brom, where they have a particular affinity with the 23rd Psalm, which I find very strange. But, and a lot of clubs have chaplains, of course. Yeah. And chaplains of other faiths now, too. So, yeah, for me, it's all about allowing faith to have its natural place. And if we did that and we understood it, the world would be a much happier place. And to be honest, I don't think we've got any choice. The world is a multi-faith place. And I'm quite sure that God is wanting us to love each other. Hold on to your faith too. I mean, all my interactions with other faiths have made me, I feel, a better Christian. They've not persuaded me of other things. I now know more about my faith. And I don't think we should be frightened of that encounter.
Mm. Yeah, tell me more about that and how you think Christians who are listening can perhaps dip a toe in those interfaith waters if they haven't already. You know, for Christians listening who might think, like, I don't get it, why would I need to go out of my way to befriend and get to know someone of another faith? I know what I think already. Just speak more about why that's been helpful and important for you in your life and in having those kind of broader friendships.
Well, I run a leadership program with others, and indeed the wonderful Lord Chris Ravel at St George's Windsor, and we bring together seven Jews, seven Muslims, seven Christians over 3 2-night modules, and we give them leadership training. But actually what happens is friendships build up across the divides. That's the hidden reason we do it. They learn about leadership, but actually it's the relationships. It's all about relationships. And getting into relationships with people, there is a certain element of vulnerability, and that there has to be. And we use a technique called scriptural reasoning, where we read our text alongside each other. We have a theme, and then we look at three passages from the Quran, the Hebrew scriptures, and the Christian Gospels. And we discuss them together. And it's a slightly dangerous thing to do. But if you do it with love and understanding and hospitality, it becomes revelatory. So to allow a Muslim to look at a text from Mark's Gospel, I've had the scales have fallen from my eyes. I thought, I've never looked at it like that before. But to get to that point, you need to be comfortable with your own faith and not threatened. I mean, nothing a Muslim says to me will stop me from looking at Jesus the way I love him. But it can provide a huge insight. And then although it's difficult for them too, a Muslim having a Christian comment on their faith has the same effect. Sometimes it's like people are bristling when they go into this process. But when they do it, it can become a real channel to a whole new vision of how we can be together.
Wow. That's so interesting. We're sadly running out of time, but I wanted to finish by talking about the media landscape as it is now, because, dare I say, it's quite different from when you began in journalism. And I saw a headline the other day that said Brits now watch more YouTube than the BBC. And we've mentioned them already, but these digital platforms, some people will be listening to this as a podcast as we speak, but whether it's podcast, social media, video, YouTube, you know, some are a bit concerned these things are kind of overtaking what we might call traditional media. Is that a problem for you?
Well, no. But I mean, we've got to accept it. That is the way the world is going. And as I said earlier, we should welcome it with open arms. Make it ours. You know, if there's a whole lots of terrible nonsense out there, well, let's make sure there's lots of really good stuff too. I mean, I don't think there's any way back from that. We can't go and bury our heads in the sand and rewind the clock and pretend, you know, that it's 1975 again. It just isn't. We are where we are.
And for Christians, you know, I speak to Christians, feel quite overwhelmed actually about the amount of news that is coming at them in all these different places, whether it's loading up Facebook or looking at the BBC or reading social media. And you know, there has been this trend from some actually just to switch off news completely because it's been a bit overwhelming. What would be your advice to Christians who want to carefully and responsibly engage with the world that exists in all of its forms? And some of the news is quite depressing, but they want to engage. They want to be prayerful, actually, about the world in which we live. They want to be informed. What is your advice to Christians who say, how and where, you know, where do I go? Where's trustworthy these days? How can I engage properly with media, but media that's trustworthy, because there's a lot of noise out there as well?
Well, it's important, I think, and I try to do this, to make yourself a bit uncomfortable, to get outside your circle and to try and see what other people are doing and saying, and try not to find that overwhelmingly threatening, but allow it to infuse into your understanding and allow your faith to speak to that, with that, and understand that. So I think if we only ever look at what the algorithms give us, because that's what we only ever look at, you can end up just disappearing completely, and you won't have a clue of what else is going on. I mean, there's no doubt it's awful, the stuff that's out there. Unbelievable things going on, which are just terrible. But we mustn't lose heart. I think our God is bigger than all that, and I think he wants us to be brave and to live in the real world and don't try and pretend it's not there, and kind of get stuck in. Have faith. In the end, we know good wins in the end.
Amen. Amen. True words. Michael Wakelin, thank you so much for joining us on The Profile. It's been a real pleasure and an honour. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.